and was a yoke, an iron collar, a shackle. Each man had his own shackle, but the chain was shared by everyone, so that if the 24 men got down from the dray to walk, they were seized by a sort of inexorable unity and had to snake along the ground with the chain as a backbone, a bit like a centipede. At the front and back of each car, two men, armed with guns, stood, each with one end of the chain underfoot. The collar shackles were square. The seventh car, a huge wagon that had side panels but no cover, had four wheels and six horses, and was carrying a rattling pile of iron boilers, cast-iron melting pots, stoves and chains, and mixed up in all that, a few men, trussed and laid out flat, who looked to be sick. This wagon, entirely made of latticework, was equipped with dilapidated racks that looked like they might once have been used in torture. The cars kept to the middle of the pavement. On either side, a double row of guards marched, looking pretty scruffy under tricorn hats, like those worn by the soldiers of the Directoire, stained, riddled with holes, dirty, decked out in the uniforms of the war disabled and the breeches of undertakers' assistants, half grey, half blue, practically in tatters, with red epaulets, yellow cross belts, sheath knives, muskets and clubs. A ragtag lot of soldier thugs. These henchmen seemed to combine the abjectness of beggars and the authority of hangmen. The one who looked to be the chief held a horsewhip in his hand. All these details, blurred by the half-light, stood out more clearly as day came on. At the head and rear of the convoy, gendarmes on horseback trotted along gravely, sabers at the ready. This cortege was so long that the first car had already reached the barriere as the last one was just turning off the boulevard. A crowd had surfaced from who knows where and gathered in the blink of an eye, as often happens in Paris, pressing in from both sides of the road to gape. You could hear people yelling at each other in the neighboring lanes and the wooden clogs of the market gardeners as they ran to get a look. The men piled up on the drays let themselves be jolted along in silence. They were wan with the morning chill. They all had coarse cotton breeches and wooden shoes on their bare feet. The rest of their raiment was whatever dire poverty could devise. Their accessories were hideously ill-matched. Nothing is more mournful than the harlequin in rags. Staved-in felt hats, tarred caps, awful woolen beanies, and, alongside a workman's smock, a black coat gone at the elbows. Several of them had women's hats. Others had clapped baskets on their heads. Hairy chests were on show, and through the tears in their clothing flashed tattoos, temples of love, burning hearts, little cupids. You could also see patches of red or scurfy skin that looked very unsavory. Two or three of them had a straw rope tied to the struts of the wagon, which hung down under them like a stirrup and supported their feet. One of them was holding something in his hand that he brought to his mouth and that looked like a black stone he appeared to bite into. This was bread, and he was eating it. There were nothing but dry eyes among them, listless or shining, with an ugly glint. The escort troops were grumbling. The men in chains did not breathe a whisper. From time to time you could hear the noise of a club coming down with a whack across shoulder blades or on a head. Some of the men yawned. Their rags were terrible. Their feet dangled. Their shoulders rocked. Their heads banged together. Their irons clanked. Their eyes blazed fiercely, their fists clenched or opened, as inert as the hands of the dead. Behind the convoy, a troop of children burst out laughing. This file of cars, whatever it was doleful. It was obvious that the next day, in an hour's time, it might pour with rain, with one shower followed by another shower, and another, and that these ruins of clothes would be soaked through, and once they were wet, the men would not dry off again, that once they were frozen, they would not thaw out again, that their canvas pants would stick to their bones with the rain, that the water would fill their shoes, that the lashes of the whip would not stop their teeth chattering, that the chain would go on holding them by the neck, that their feet would go on dangling over the side. And it was impossible not to shudder on seeing these human beings tied up like this, and passive under the cold autumn clouds, and delivered up to the rain, to the icy wind, to all the furies of the air, like trees, like stones. The whacks of the clubs did not even spare the sick who groaned, trussed with ropes and motionless, on the seventh car, and who looked as though they'd been thrown there like sacks full of misery. Suddenly, the sun came out. An immense shaft of sunlight shot out from the east and seemed to set fire to all these fierce heads. Tongues were loosened. A firestorm of jeering and swearing and singing erupted. The broad horizontal light cut the whole field in two, illuminating heads and torsos, leaving feet and wheels in darkness. Thoughts appeared on faces. That was an appalling moment, revealing demons with their masks off, visible, savage souls laid completely bare. Lit up, this mob remained dark. Some of them, the cheery ones, had quill pipes through which they blew vermin at the crowd, singling out the women. Dawn exaggerated the lamentable profiles through the blackness of the shadows. There was not one being among them who was not disfigured by misery, and this was so monstrous that you would have said it changed the brightness of the sun into a lightning flash. The wagon load that headed the convoy struck up a tune, which they began belting out at the top of their lungs with frantic joviality. It was La Vestale, one of Desaugiers's medleys, famous at the time. The trees shivered forlornly. In the side alleys, the faces of the bourgeois throng were covered in moronic bliss as they listened, riveted, to these bawdy ditties sung by specters. Every kind of distress was in that convoy in a tangled heap. Every cut of head of all the beasts was there, old men, adolescents, bare skulls, grey beards, cynical monstrosities, aggressive resignation, savage grimacing, insane posturing, muzzles with caps on, heads a bit like young girls with corkscrew curls over the temples, faces that were childish and, because of that, horrible. The fleshless faces of skeletons where only death was missing. On the first car, you could see a black man who had once, perhaps, been a slave and could compare chains. That terrifying lowest common denominator, shame, had passed over these foreheads. At this level of debasement, the final transformations were undergone by all in the final depths, absolute rock bottom, and ignorance turned to stupor was indistinguishable from intelligence turned to despair. No choice was possible between these men who appeared to onlookers to be the elite of the gutter, the scum of the earth. It was clear that whoever was in charge of this sordid procession had not bothered to sort them. These creatures had been bound and paired off willy-nilly, probably in alphabetic disorder, and loaded haphazardly onto the carts. But when horrors are lumped together, they always yield a result. Every addition to the count of the miserable yields a total. From each chain, a common soul emerged, and each cartload had its distinctive countenance. Besides the one that was singing, there was one that was shouting. A third was begging. You could see one that was gnashing its teeth. Another threatened bystanders, another railed against God in sheer blasphemy. The last kept as silent as the grave. Dante would have thought he was seeing the seven circles of hell on the march. The march of the damned toward their damnation, undertaken sinisterly, not on the awesome flashing chariot of the apocalypse, but more somber still, on the cart of the Gemonii, the hangman's cart. One of the guards, who had a hook on the end of his club, made a show of stirring this pile of human refuse now and then. An old woman in the crowd pointed them out to a little boy of five and said to him, "That'll teach you to behave, you little rascal." As the singing and blaspheming got louder, the man who seemed to be the captain of the escort cracked his whip, and at that signal, a frightening, muffled, and blind bludgeoning fell on the seven carts with a noise like hail. Many roared and foamed at the mouth, which only redoubled the joy of the urchins who had come running, a cloud of flies on these open wounds. Jean Valjean's eyes had become frightening. They were no longer eyes, they were the deep window on the soul that replaces gazing eyes in certain long-suffering people. Such a look seems oblivious to reality, reflecting past horrors and calamities in a blaze of fierce light. He was not looking at a spectacle. He was enduring a vision. He tried to stand, to run, to escape. He could not move a muscle. Sometimes the things you see grab you and hold you in place. He stayed nailed to the spot, petrified, dumbstruck, wondering, through a confused and inexpressible anguish, what this sepulchral persecution meant and where the pandemonium that was hounding him came from. All of a sudden, he clapped his hand on his forehead, which you usually do when your memory suddenly comes back to you. He remembered that this was in fact the route, that this was the customary detour to avoid royal encounters which were always possible on the Fontainebleau Road, and that 35 years previously he had passed by this very same barrière. Cosette was just as horrified, but in a slightly different way. She did not understand. She could not breathe. What she was seeing did not seem possible to her. She finally cried out, "Father, what is in those cars?" Jean Valjean answered, "Convicts." "Where are they going?" "To the galleys." At that moment, the bludgeoning, multiplied by 100 hands, was reaching a crescendo and extended to include whacking with the flats of swords. The galley slaves crouched down, bent double under this storm of whips and clubs. A ghastly obeisance was produced by the torture, and all fell silent, with a look of chained wolves. Cosette was shaking from head to toe. She went on, "Father, are these men?" "At times," said the wretched man. It was, in fact, the chain gang, which had set out before daybreak from Bicêtre and was taking the Mans Road to avoid Fontainebleau, where the king was. This detour made the whole horrifying trip last 3 or 4 days longer. But to spare the royal person the sight of such torture, it was certainly worth prolonging. Jean Valjean went home shattered. Such encounters are a shock to the system, and the memory they leave is like a convulsion. Yet on the way back to the Rue de Babylone with Cosette, Jean Valjean did not notice that she asked him other questions about what they had just seen. Maybe he was too absorbed in his own utter dejection to register what she said and to respond. Only that evening, as Cosette was saying good night before going to bed, did he hear her say, in a faint little voice as though to herself, "I think that if ever I ran into one of those men in a dark alley, my God, I'd die just seeing him up close." Luckily, chance would have it that the day after this tragic day, there was some kind of official celebration. I don't remember what was being celebrated exactly, and formal festivities took place all over Paris. A military review in the Champ de Mars, jousting on the Seine, theatricals along the Champs-Élysées, fireworks at L'Étoile, light shows everywhere. Jean Valjean, doing violence to his habits, took Cosette to see the festivities to distract her from the memory of the day before and to erase the abominable thing that had passed before her in the laughing tumult of Le Tout Paris. The review that enlivened the celebrations made the parade of uniforms completely natural. Jean Valjean donned his National Guard uniform with the vague inner feeling of a man taking refuge. But the goal of the outing seemed achieved. Cosette, who made it a rule to please her father and for whom, in any case, all spectacle was fresh and new, accepted the distraction blithely with the good grace of adolescence and did not pout too disdainfully at this joyful romp known as a fête, so much so that Jean Valjean could tell himself he'd carried it off and that no trace of the hideous sight remained. One morning, several days later, they were both sitting on the garden steps in bright sunshine, another infringement of the rules Jean Valjean seemed to impose, and of the habit of keeping to her room that sadness had caused Cosette to adopt. Cosette was standing in her dressing gown, carefree in her early morning negligee, with a casualness that wraps young girls round as adorably as a cloud covering a star. Her face all rosy from having slept so well, she stood in the light under the loving gaze of the tender old man, pulling the petals off a daisy. Cosette knew nothing of that delightful little riddle, "He loves me, he loves me not, he loves me," etc. Who would have taught her? She was handling the flower instinctively, innocently, without suspecting that pulling the petals off a daisy is to pluck a heart. If there had been a fourth grace named Melancholy, who smiled, she would have looked like that grace. Jean Valjean was spellbound by those little fingers working that little flower, forgetting everything else in the child's radiance. A red robin was twittering in the bushes beside them. White clouds were scudding across the sky as gaily as if they had just been released from captivity. Cosette continued to pluck her daisies attentively. She seemed to be thinking about something, but it must have been something lovely. All of a sudden she turned her head back over her shoulder, as delicately and slowly as a swan, and shot Jean Valjean a question. "Father, what are they actually, these galleys?"
Book 4. Help from below, maybe help from above. Wound without, healing within. And so, their life gradually came under a cloud. There was only one diversion left to them, one that had once been a joy, and that was to take bread to those who were hungry and clothes to those who were cold. On these visits to the poor, on which Cosette often accompanied Jean Valjean, they found once more some remnant of their old open-hearted intimacy. And sometimes, when it had been a good day, when many in distress had been relieved, and many little children revived and made warm, Cosette would be almost light-hearted in the evening. It was at this time that they had paid a visit to the Jondrette pigsty. The very day after that visit, Jean Valjean appeared in the villa in the morning, calm as usual, but with a great big wound on his left arm. Highly inflamed, highly infected, it looked like a burn, but he brushed it off with some banal explanation. This wound meant he was housebound with fever for over a month. He would not see a doctor. When Cosette urged him to do so, he would say, "Send for the dog doctor." Cosette dressed the wound morning and night with such a divine expression on her face, and such angelic happiness at being useful to him, that Jean Valjean felt all his old joy return, his fears and anxieties evaporate, and he would gaze at Cosette, saying, "Oh, what a blessed wound! Oh, what blessed pain!" Cosette, seeing her father sick and wounded, had deserted the villa, regaining her taste for the little cottage and the backyard. She spent nearly all her time by Jean Valjean's side, reading whatever books he liked to him, in general, travel books. Jean Valjean was born anew, his happiness revived with ineffable radiance. The Luxembourg, the unknown young prowler, Cosette's cooling off, all these clouds in his soul dissolved. It got to the point where he said to himself, "I must have imagined all that. I'm such an old goose." His happiness was such that the appalling discovery of the Thénardiers in the Jondrette hole, though so unexpected, was water off a duck's back to him now. He had managed to escape. His own tracks were covered. What did the rest matter to him? He only thought about it at all to feel sorry for those poor bastards. "They're all in jail now, and can do no more harm," he thought. But what a lamentable family in distress. As for the hideous vision at the Barrière du Maine, Cosette had not mentioned it again. At the convent, Sister Saint Mechtilde had taught Cosette music. Cosette had the voice of a warbler with a soul, and sometimes in the evening, in the invalid's humble cottage, she would sing sad songs that brought joy to Jean Valjean's heart. Spring was coming. The garden was so beautiful at that time of year that Jean Valjean said to Cosette, "You never go into the garden anymore. I want you to walk around in it." "As you like, father," said Cosette. And just to obey her father, she resumed her walks in her garden, most often alone, for, as we pointed out, Jean Valjean, who possibly feared being seen through the gate, almost never set foot there. Jean Valjean's wound had been a diversion. When Cosette saw that her father was not in so much pain, that he was on the mend, that he seemed happy, she felt a contentment she didn't even realize. It came on so gently and so naturally. Then it was the month of March. The days were getting longer. Winter was going, and winter always takes something of our sorrows with it. Then April came, that summer's dawn, fresh like all dawns, gay like all childhoods, A little bit of a crybaby, in fact, like all newborns. Nature in the month of April is full of that glorious light that travels from the sky, the clouds, the trees, the meadows, and the flowers, right into the heart of humankind. Cosette was still too young for the joy of April, so like her, not to find its way into her heart. Insensibly, and without her suspecting a thing, the darkness lifted off her spirit. In spring, the light shines in sad souls just as it shines in caves at midday. Even Cosette was no longer so very sad. Anyway, that's how it was, and Cosette was not aware of it. In the morning, after breakfast, at about 10, when she had managed to drag her father out into the garden for 15 minutes, and was walking him in the sun at the bottom of the garden steps, supporting his wounded arm for him, she did not realize that she laughed at every turn and that she was happy. Jean Valjean was deliriously happy to see her becoming all fresh and rosy again. "Oh, what a blessed wound," he repeated in a hushed voice. And he was grateful to the Thénardiers. As soon as his wound was healed, he resumed his solitary walks in the gloaming. It would be a mistake to think you can walk around like this on your own in uninhabited areas of Paris without meeting with some adventure. Mother Plutarch doesn't mind explaining a phenomenon. One night, Petit Gavroche had not eaten. He remembered that he had not eaten the night before either. This was getting tedious. He resolved to try and get himself some supper. He went on the prowl in the deserted no-man's land beyond La Salpêtrière. That is where the windfalls are. Where there is no one, you always find something. He got as far as a settlement that looked to him to be the village of Austerlitz. On one of his previous reconnoiters, he had noticed an old garden there, haunted by an old man and an old woman, and in this garden, a passable apple tree. Beside the apple tree there was a sort of fruit shed where a person could land himself an apple. An apple is a meal in itself. An apple is life. What sank Adam might save Gavroche. The garden ran alongside a lonely, unpaved laneway that was bordered with bushes for want of houses. A hedge separated the garden from the lane. Gavroche headed for the garden. He came to the lane, recognized the apple tree, checked the fruit shed, examined the hedge. A hedge is a leg up. Day was dimming. There was not even a cat in the lane. The time was right. Gavroche began scaling the hedge, then suddenly stopped in his tracks. Someone was talking in the garden. Gavroche peered through a hole in the hedge. 2 feet away, at the base of the hedge and on the other side, exactly at the point where the gap he was considering would have dropped him, there was an overturned stone that made a kind of bench, and on this bench the old man of the garden was sitting, with the old woman standing in front of him. The old woman was grumbling. Gavroche, who was anything but discreet, listened in. "Monsieur Mabeuf," the old woman was saying. "Mabeuf," thought Gavroche, "what a funny name." The old man addressed did not stir. The old woman repeated, "Monsieur Mabeuf." The old man kept his eyes on the ground, but decided to reply. "What, Mother Plutarch?" "Mother Plutarch," thought Gavroche, "another funny name." Mother Plutarch went on, and the old man was forced to join in the conversation.
"The landlord is not happy."
"Why is that?"
"He's owed 3/4.
"In 3 months he'll be owed 4.
"He says he'll turn you out."
"I'll go."
"The fruit hawker woman wants to be paid. She won't let you have any more bundles of firewood. How will you keep yourself warm this winter? We won't have any wood."
"There's always the sun."
"The butcher's refusing credit. He won't give us any more meat."
"Well and good. Meat's bad for my digestion. It's too heavy."
"What will you have for dinner?"
"Bread."
"The baker's demanding an installment and says no money, no bread."
"Good-o."
"What are you going to eat?"
"There's always the apples from the apple tree."
"But, monsieur, a person just can't live like that without money."
"I don't have any." The old woman beetled off. The old man remained alone. He set to thinking. Gavroche was thinking alongside him. It was almost night. The first result of Gavroche's thinking was that instead of scaling the hedge, he decided to crawl under it.
The branches separated a bit at the bottom of the bush.
"Look at that," cried Gavroche to himself, "an alcove."
And he crept in. He was now practically back to back with Father Mabeuf's bench. He could hear the octogenarian breathing. So, for dinner, he tried to sleep. A catnap, sleeping with one eye open. Even while he dozed off, Gavroche was on the lookout. The whiteness of the twilight sky bleached the ground, and the lane made a livid line between two rows of black bushes. All of a sudden, on that whitish band, two silhouettes appeared. One was out in front, the other some distance behind.
"Here's trouble," muttered Gavroche.
The first silhouette looked to be that of some old bourgeois gentleman, stooped and deep in thought, dressed remarkably plainly, and walking slowly because of his age, out for an amble under the stars. The second was straight, firm, slight. It was walking in step with the first, but in that deliberate snail's crawl, you could sense suppleness and coiled agility. This silhouette had something unspeakably mean and disturbing about it. The whole look was of what was then known as a fop. The hat was stylish, the redingote coat was black, well cut, probably of good fabric, and cinched at the waist. The head was held high, with a sort of robust grace, and beneath the hat, you caught a glimpse in the twilight of a pale adolescent's face. The face had a rose in its mouth. This second silhouette was well known to Gavroche. It was Montparnasse. As for the other, he really could not have said anything except that it was some old geezer. Gavroche went into observation mode immediately. One of the two out walking clearly had designs on the other. Gavroche was well placed to see what happened next. The alcove had very conveniently turned into a spy hole. Montparnasse on the hunt at such an hour, in such a place. This was menacing. Gavroche felt his little boy's heart lurch with pity for the old fellow. What could he do? Intervene? That would amount to one weakling trying to rescue another. It would give Montparnasse a good laugh. Gavroche did not disguise the fact that this fearful cutthroat of 18 would have them both for supper, the old man first, the child next. While Gavroche was deliberating, the assault took place, abrupt and awful. A tiger attacking a wild ass, a spider attacking a fly. Without further ado, Montparnasse chucked the rose, lunged at the old man, collared him, grabbed hold of him, and hung on tight, and it was all Gavroche could do not to let out a scream. A moment later, one of the men was under the other one, exhausted, panting, flailing about, with a knee of marble on his chest. Only, it wasn't exactly what Gavroche was expecting. The one on the ground was Montparnasse. The one on top was the old man. All of this happened just a few feet from Gavroche. The old man had had a shock and had given as good as he got, and so terribly that in the blink of an eye, assailant and assailed had switched places. "There's a proud old war veteran for you," thought Gavroche. And he couldn't stop himself from clapping. But the clap was lost. It did not reach the two combatants, absorbed and deafened by each other as they were, their breath mingled in the fray. There was a silence. Montparnasse stopped struggling. Gavroche said to himself, "Is he dead?" The old bloke had not uttered a sound, not a word or a cry. He picked himself up, and Gavroche heard him say to Montparnasse, "Get up." Montparnasse got up, but the old man held him tight. Montparnasse had the furious, humiliated look of a wolf that has been snatched by a sheep. Gavroche watched and listened, all eyes and ears. He was enjoying himself immensely. He was rewarded for his conscientious anxiety as a spectator, for he was able to catch the following dialogue, which borrowed an indescribably tragic tone from the darkness. The old man asked the questions. Montparnasse answered. "How old are you?"
19.
"You're strong and fit. Why aren't you at work?"
"Work bores me."
"What is your occupation?"
"Lay about."
"Be serious. Can I do anything for you? What would you like to be?"
"A thief."
There was a silence. The old man seemed deep in thought. He stood stock still, but did not let go of Montparnasse. Now and then the young villain, vigorous and deft, thrashed around like an animal caught in a trap. He gave a jerk, tried to trip the old man up, wildly writhing and twisting his limbs, attempted to break free. The old man didn't even seem to notice as he held both his arms with a single hand, with the sovereign indifference of unassailable strength. The The old man's trance lasted a while, then he fixed his eyes steadily on Montparnasse, gently raised his voice, and delivered him, from out of the shadows where they were standing, a sort of solemn address which Gavroche did not lose a syllable of. "My boy, you are embarking on one of the most laborious of existences out of sheer laziness. You declare yourself a layabout. Get ready to work. Have you ever seen a very frightening machine called a rolling mill? You have to take great care with it. It's a sly and savage thing. If it catches a flap of your coat, the whole of you goes in. This machine is idleness. Stop while there's still time and save yourself. Otherwise, it's all over for you. Before too long, you'll be caught in the wheels. Once you're caught, don't hope for another thing again. Till you drop, lazy bones, forget about rest. The iron hand of relentless work will have grabbed you. Earn your living, have a job, perform a duty. You won't have any of that. Being like everyone else bores you, well then, you will be different. Work is the rule. Whoever rejects it as boring will have it as torture. You don't want to be a working man, you will be a slave. Work only drops you now to pick you up again later. You don't want to be its friend, you will be its navvy. You don't want any of the honest weariness of men. You will have the sweat of the damned. Where others sing, you will moan. You will see from afar, from below, other men working. It will look to you like they are resting. The laborer, the reaper, the sailor, the blacksmith will appear to you in the light as the blessed in some paradise. What radiance in the anvil! To drive a plough, to bind sheaves, sheer bliss! The boat free in the breeze, what a holiday! You, lazy bones, dig, drag, roll, march, drag your yoke. There you go, you're a beast of burden in the harness from hell. To do nothing, that was your goal. Well then, not a week, not a day, not an hour goes by without shattering exhaustion. You can't lift a thing except in anguish. Every minute that passes will make your muscles crack. What is a mere feather for others will be a rock for you. The simplest things will overpower you. Life will turn into a monster around you. Coming and going, even breathing, will be so many terrible travails. Your lungs will feel like they are lifting 100-pound weight. To walk here rather than over there will be a problem to be solved. Any other man who wants to go out pushes his door open and there, it's done, he's outside. You? If you want to go out, you'll have to bore through your wall. To go out into the street? What does everybody else do? Everybody else goes downstairs. You? You'll rip up your bedsheets, you'll tie them together, strip by strip, and make a rope, then you'll go out your window and you'll hang there by this thread over an abyss. And it'll be at night, in a storm, in the rain, in a hurricane. And if the rope is too short, you'll only have one way left to get down, and that will mean dropping. Dropping any which way, into the void, from whatever height, onto what? Onto whatever is below, onto the unknown. Or you'll climb up a chimney at the risk of getting burned. Or you'll crawl along a sewer at the risk of getting drowned. I won't mention the holes you'll have to cover up, the stones you'll have to take out and put back 20 times a day. The rubble you'll have to hide in your straw pallet. A lock presents itself. The bourgeois has his key made by a locksmith there in his pocket. You, if you want to get in, you're condemned to making an awesome masterpiece. You'll take a sou. You'll cut it into 2 sections. With what tools? You'll have to invent them. That's your problem. Then you'll hollow out the inside of these 2 sections, handling the outside very carefully, and you'll cut a screw thread all around the edge, so that they fit together perfectly, like a top and bottom lid. With the bottom and the top screwed together in this fashion, nobody would suspect a thing. To those watching you, for you will be watched, it will be a sou. To you, it will be a box. What will you put in this box? A tiny bit of steel. A watch spring that you'll have cut teeth into and which will become a saw. With this saw, as long as a pin and hidden in the sou, you'll have to cut the bolt of the lock, the slide of the bolt, the latch of the padlock, and the bar you'll have at your window, and the shackle you'll have on your leg. This masterpiece made, this marvel accomplished, all these miracles of art, skill, cleverness, patience executed. If it comes to be known that you are their author, what will be your reward? The dungeon. There's the future for you. Laziness, pleasure, what bottomless pits! To do nothing is a woeful choice to make, don't you know? To live idly off the substance of society. To be useless, that is noxious. That leads straight to the direst misery.
Woe to the man who wants to be a parasite. He will be vermin. You don't like the idea of working. There's only one thing on your mind. To drink well, to eat well, to sleep well. You'll drink water. You'll eat black bread. You'll sleep on a plank with irons riveted to your limbs, and you'll feel how cold they are at night against your skin. You'll break this iron. You'll run away. Very well. You'll be crawling on your stomach through the scrub, and you'll eat grass like the brutes of the woods. And you'll be nabbed again. And then you'll spend years in a dungeon, bolted to a wall, groping for a drink from your pitcher, gnawing on a horrible loaf of blackness even dogs wouldn't touch, eating beans the worms would have got to before you. You'll be a woodlouse in a cellar. Have pity on yourself, miserable child. So young, you can't have been sucking at your nurse's tits more than 20 years ago. And doubtless, you still have your mother. I implore you, listen to me. You want fine black fabric, patent leather shoes. You want your hair crimped, to run sweet-smelling oil through your curly locks, to please the ladies, to be a pretty boy. You'll be shaved bald, and you'll wear a red smock and wooden clogs. You want a ring on your finger, you'll have an iron collar around your neck. And if you so much as look at a woman, a whack of the club. You'll go in at 20, and you'll come out at 50. You'll go in young, rosy, fresh, with your sparkling eyes and your white teeth and your beautiful adolescent head of hair, and you'll come out broken, stooped, wrinkled, toothless, horrible, with white hair. My poor boy, you're going the wrong way. Laziness is giving you bad advice. The toughest of all work is theft. Believe me, do not take on the dreadful drudgery of being a layabout. To become a villain is not easy. It's easier to become an honest man. Go now, and think about what I've told you. Speaking of which, what did you want from me? My purse? Here it is. And the old man let go of Montparnasse, and put his purse in Montparnasse's hand. Montparnasse weighed it for a moment, after which, with the same mechanical precaution he'd have taken if he'd stolen it, he slipped it gently into the back pocket of his redingote. When all this was said and done, the old man turned his back and quietly resumed his stroll. "Silly old codger," murmured Montparnasse. Who was this old man? The reader has no doubt guessed. Montparnasse stood stunned, watching him disappear in the twilight. This contemplation was fatal to him. While the old man was disappearing into the distance, Gavroche was stealing closer. Out of the corner of his eye, Gavroche had assured himself that Father Mabeuf was still sitting on the bench, though perhaps asleep now. Then the little urchin came out of his bush and began to creep along in the shadows behind the motionless Montparnasse. He reached Montparnasse accordingly, without being seen or heard, gently insinuated his hand into the back pocket of the redingote, a fine black fabric, grabbed the purse, withdrew his hand, and creeping off again, made good his escape like a garter snake in the gathering gloom. Having no reason to be on his guard, and actually thinking for the first time in his life, Montparnasse didn't feel a thing. When he got back to the spot where Father Mabeuf was, Gavroche threw the purse over the hedge and ran away as fast as his legs would carry him. The purse fell on Father Mabeuf's foot. The commotion woke him. He bent down and picked it up. He could not make head or tail of it. He opened it. It was a purse with two compartments. In one, there were a few small coins. In the other, there were 6 napoleons. Monsieur Mabeuf was startled out of his wits, and took the thing to his housekeeper.
"This has fallen from the sky," said Mother Plutarch.
Book 5. Whose End is Nothing Like Its Beginning. Loneliness and the Barracks Combined. Cosette's pain, still so poignant and so acute 4 or 5 months before, had entered into the convalescent phase, without her even noticing. Nature, springtime, youth, her love for her father, the gaiety of the birds and the flowers, caused something almost like forgetting to trickle little by little, day by day, drop by drop into this soul so virginal and young. Was the fire dying out there completely? Or was a layer of ash simply forming? The fact is that she now hardly felt any of those sore spots, once so burning. One day she suddenly thought of Malus.
"Fancy," she said, "I never think about him anymore."
That same week she noticed a very good-looking officer of the Lancers going by the garden gate. A man with a wasp waist, a ravishing uniform, the rosy cheeks of a girl, a saber under his arm, a waxed moustache, and a polished lancer's cap. Add to that blonde hair, striking blue eyes, a round, vain, insolent, and pretty face, the absolute opposite of Marius. He even had a cigar in his mouth. Cosette thought this officer had to be in the regiment's barracked in the Rue de Babylone. The next day she saw him go by again. She noted the time, dating from that moment. Was it purely by chance? She saw him go by almost every day. The officer's friends noticed that in that badly kept garden, behind that nasty rococo gate, there was a rather pretty creature who was almost always to be found dawdling about when the good-looking lieutenant went by, a man not unknown to the reader, going as he did by the name of Théodule Gillenormand. "Wait," they said to him, "there's a girl there giving you the eye. Go on, look."
"Do you think I have time," answered the lancer, "to look at all the girls who look at me?"
This was precisely the time that Marius was gravitating seriously toward death, and telling himself, "If only I could see her one more time before I die." If his wish had been granted, if he had at that moment seen Cosette ogling a lancer, he would have died of pain without being able to utter a word. Whose fault was it? No one's. Marius had the sort of temperament that sinks deep into sorrow and stays there wallowing. Cosette was of those who dive in and resurface fairly fast. Cosette, what's more, was going through that phase, so dangerous, so fatal to a woman's development, when she is left to her own devices, when her lonely young girl's heart is like the tendrils of the vine, clinging willy-nilly to the capital of a marble column or a cabaret signpost. A quick and decisive moment, critical for every orphan, whether poor or rich, for wealth does not protect you from making a bad choice. Misalliances are made very high up the ladder. The true misalliance is that of souls. And just as more than one unknown young man, without name, without birth, without fortune, is a marble capital that supports a temple of grand feelings and grand ideas, so some other man of the world, self-satisfied and opulent, with polished boots and polished words, if you look not at the outside but at the inside, that is, at what is reserved for women, is nothing more than a crummy little dive dimly haunted by violent, sordid, and debauched passions. The cabaret signpost. What was there in Cosette's soul? Passion that had calmed down or gone to sleep? Love in a floating state, something limpid and shiny, murky at a certain depth, dark deeper down still. The image of the good-looking officer was reflected on the surface. Was there a memory at the bottom, at the very bottom? Perhaps. Cosette did not know. Something strange happened. Cosette's fears. In the first 2 weeks of April, Jean Valjean went on a trip. This, we know, was something he did from time to time at very long intervals. He stayed away 1 or 2 days at most. Where did he go? No one knew, not even Cosette. Only once at one of these departures had she accompanied him in a fiacre as far as the corner of a little cul-de-sac where she read Impasse de la Planchette. There, he had got down, and the fiacre had taken Cosette back to the Rue de Babylone. It was usually when the household money was running out that Jean Valjean went on these little trips. So Jean Valjean was away. He had said, "I'll be back in 3 days." That evening Cosette was alone in the salon. To stop herself from being bored, she had opened her piano organ and had started to sing, accompanying herself, the chorus from Euryanthe, Hunters Lost in the Woods, which is perhaps the most beautiful thing in all music. When she had finished, she remained pensive. All of a sudden, she thought she heard someone walking in the garden. It couldn't be her father. He was away. It couldn't be Toussaint. She was in bed. It was 10 o'clock at night. She went to the salon window, which was shut and shuttered, and pressed her ear against it. It seemed to her that it was a man's tread, and that whoever it was walking very softly. She flew upstairs to her bedroom, opened a transom, cut into her shutters, and looked out at the garden. There was a full moon that night. You could see as clearly as in broad daylight. There was no one there. She opened the window. The garden was absolutely still, and all you could see of the street was deserted, as always. Cosette thought she must have imagined it. She had only thought she'd heard the noise. It was a hallucination brought on by Weber's somber and majestic chorus, opening up as it does bewildering depths before the mind and shimmering before your eyes like a dizzying forest, in which you hear the crackling of dead branches under the anxious feet of hunters glimpsed in the twilight. She thought no more of it. Besides, Cosette was not by nature easily frightened. There was in her veins the blood of the bohemian and the adventurer who goes about barefoot. As you'll recall, she was more of a lark than a dove. In her heart of hearts, she was wild and brave. The next day, not so late, at nightfall, she was strolling around the garden. Amid the jumble of thoughts that were preoccupying her, she was fairly sure she could hear the same sound as the night before, now and again the sound of someone walking in the dark, under the trees, pretty close by. But she told herself that nothing resembles the sound of footfalls in grass as much as two branches rubbing against each other, and she took no more notice. Besides, she couldn't see anything. She emerged from the bushes, and now only had to cut across a small green lawn to reach the steps. The moon, which had just risen behind her, cast her shadow in front of her on the lawn as she came out of the flower beds. Cosette stopped in her tracks, terrified. Next to her shadow, the moon distinctly threw another shadow on the lawn, one strangely frightening and terrible, a shadow with a round hat. It was like the shadow of a man standing on the edge of the flower beds, just a few feet behind Cosette. For a moment she could not speak or cry out or call for help or move or turn her head. Finally she mustered all her courage and spun around resolutely. There was no one there. She looked at the ground. The shadow had disappeared. She ducked back into the bushes, boldly ferreted around in all the nooks and crannies, went as far as the gate, and came up empty. Her blood was like ice in her veins. Was it yet another hallucination? What, 2 days in a row? One hallucination, all right, but two hallucinations? What was truly disturbing was that the shadow was assuredly not a ghost. Ghosts hardly ever wear round hats. The next day, Jean Valjean came back. Cosette told him what she thought she'd heard and seen. She expected to be reassured that her father would just shrug his shoulders and tell her, "You're a silly little girl." Jean Valjean was worried. "It can't be anything," he said. He made some excuse to leave her and went into the garden, and she saw him examining the gate very carefully. That night she woke up. This time she was sure she distinctly heard someone walking quite close to the steps under her window. She ran to her transom and opened it. There, in the garden, there was indeed a man, holding a big stick in his hand. Just as she was about to cry out, the moon lit the man's profile. It was her father. She went back to bed, telling herself, "That means he's really worried." Jean Valjean spent that night in the garden and the 2 nights that followed. Cosette could see him through the peephole in her shutters. The third night, the moon was waning and starting to rise later. It might have been 1 o'clock in the morning. She heard a great guffaw and her father's voice calling her, "Cosette!" She leaped out of bed, threw on her dressing gown, and opened her window. Her father was down below on the lawn. "I'm waking you up to reassure you," he said. "Look, there's your shadow with a round hat." And he pointed to a long shadow that the moon cast on the lawn, and that did, indeed, bear a close resemblance to a man wearing a round hat. It was the silhouette produced by a metal chimney with a capped pot rising up above a neighboring roof. Cosette started to laugh, too. All her ghoulish speculations fell away, and the next day, over breakfast with her father, she poked fun at herself over the sinister garden, haunted by the shadows of chimney pots. Jean Valjean became perfectly relaxed again. As for Cosette, she didn't much notice whether the chimney pot was actually in the right place to cast the shadow she had seen or thought she had seen, or whether the moon was in the right spot in the sky. She didn't pose herself any questions about the weirdness of a chimney pot that is afraid of being caught in the act and darts back when you look at its shadow, for the shadow had leaped back when Cosette had turned round, and Cosette had thought she was quite sure of that. Cosette became perfectly serene again. The demonstration struck her as complete. The idea that there could have been someone walking in the garden in the evening or at night went out of her head. A few days later, though, a fresh incident occurred. Embellished by Toussaint's comments. In the garden, near the gate on the street, there was a stone bench which was protected from prying eyes by an arbor, but which a passerby could just reach at a pinch, stretching an arm through the gate and the arbor. One evening in this same month of April, Jean Valjean had gone out, and Cosette had sat down on this bench after sunset. The wind was freshening in the trees. Cosette was in a trance. An aimless sadness was taking hold of her little by little, that invincible sadness that evening brings on, and that stems, perhaps, who knows, from the mystery of the half-open grave at that hour. Fantine was, perhaps, lurking in the shadows. Cosette rose to her feet, slowly circled the garden, walking on grass wet with dew. In the midst of this melancholy somnambulism in which she was immersed, she told herself, "You really need wooden clogs to be in the garden at this hour. I'll catch a cold." She went back to the bench. As she sat down, she noticed, over where she had just been, a rather big stone that had definitely not been there a moment before. Cosette studied the stone, wondering what this could mean. All at once, the idea that the stone had not come and sat on the bench on its own, that someone had put it there, came to her and frightened her. No doubt about it, the stone was there. She did not touch it. She fled, without daring to look back, taking refuge in the house, and immediately closing the shutters on the French windows by the steps, and barring and bolting the windows. She asked Toussaint, "Is my father back yet?"
"Not yet, mademoiselle."
We have indicated Toussaint's stutter once and for all. Please permit us not to dwell on it any further. We draw the line at musical notation of a disability. Jean Valjean was a thoughtful man, and a nocturnal wanderer, and he often came home quite late at night.
"Toussaint," Cosette went on, "you are careful to barricade the shutters properly with bars at night, aren't you? At least on the garden side? Do you stick those little iron things in the little rings to lock them properly?"
"Oh, don't you worry, mademoiselle."
Toussaint never failed in this, which Cosette knew very well, but she couldn't prevent herself from adding, "Because it's so deserted around here."
"As for that," said Toussaint, "it's the honest truth. A body could be murdered in their bed before you could say boo, and with monsieur not sleeping in the house. But there's nothing to fear, mademoiselle. I lock up the windows like it was the Bastille. Women on their own, it's enough to make you shudder, I know. Can you imagine seeing a man come into your room at night and telling you to shut up and then setting about cutting your throat for you? It's not so much dying I worry about. We all die, that's all right. We know very well we have to die. It's the abomination of feeling those people pawing you, and then, again, their knives. They can't be all that sharp. Oh, God!"
"That's enough," said Cosette. "Just lock everything nice and securely."
Cosette, horrified by the melodrama improvised by Toussaint, and perhaps also by a recollection of the apparitions of the other week, which now came back to her, did not even dare say, "Go and have a look at the stone someone has put on the bench, then," for fear of having to reopen the garden door and letting those people in. She had all the doors and windows carefully shut everywhere, got Toussaint to go over the entire house, from cellar to attic, shut herself up in her room, shot the bolts, looked under her bed, got into bed, and slept, badly. The whole night she saw that stone as big as a mountain and full of caves. At sunrise, the peculiarity of the sun rising is to make us laugh at all our terrors of the night, and the laugh we have is always in proportion to the fear we have had. At sunrise, Cosette woke to dismiss her fright as a nightmare and said to herself, "What was I dreaming about? It's like those footsteps I thought I heard the other week in the garden at night. It's like the shadow of the chimney pot. Am I going to be a complete coward this time?" The sun, which was glowing red through the slits in the shutters, turned the damask curtains crimson and reassured her to such an extent that everything vanished from her thoughts, even the stone. There was no more a stone on the bench than there was a man with a round hat in the garden. I dreamed up the stone like the rest. She got dressed, went downstairs to the garden, ran to the bench, and felt a cold sweat break out, for the stone was there. But this lasted only a moment. What is fright at night is curiosity by day. "Bah," she said, "let's take a closer look." She lifted up the stone, which was sizable. There was something underneath that looked like a letter. It was a white paper envelope. Cosette snatched it. There was no address on one side, no seal on the other. Yet the envelope, although open, was not empty. You could see sheets of paper inside. Cosette fumbled inside. It was no longer fear, she felt. It was not only curiosity, it was the beginning of anxiety. Cosette pulled out the contents of the envelope, a small paper notebook, each page of which was numbered and bore a few lines written in a rather lovely hand, Cosette thought, and very fine. Cosette looked for a name. There was none. A signature. There was none. To whom was this addressed? Probably to her, since a hand had deposited the packet on the bench. Who did it come from? An irresistible fascination took hold of her. She tried to turn her eyes away from these pages that trembled in her hand. She looked up at the sky, the street, the acacias all drenched in light, the pigeons flying over a neighboring rooftop. Then all at once, her eyes swiftly dropped to the manuscript, and she told herself that she had to know what was inside. This is what she read. A heart under a stone. The reduction of the universe to one single being. The expansion of one single being into God. That is what love is. Love is the angel's greeting to the stars. How sad the soul, when it is sad out of love. What a void is the absence of the being who alone fills the world. Oh, how true it is that the loved being becomes God. You would understand God becoming jealous if the Father of all had not evidently made creation for the soul and the soul for love. A glimpse of a smile down there under a white crepe hat with a lilac veil is enough for the soul to enter the palace of dreams. God is behind all things, but all things hide God. Things are black, human beings opaque. To love someone is to make them transparent. Certain thoughts are prayers. There are moments when, whatever the body's position, the soul is on its knees. Lovers who are separated cheat absence by a thousand chimeras that nonetheless have their reality. They are prevented from seeing each other, they can't write to each other, yet they find a whole host of mysterious ways of communicating. They send each other birdsong, the perfume of flowers, the laughter of children, the sun's rays, the wind's sighs, starlight, all of creation. And why not? All God's works are made to serve love. Love is powerful enough to load the whole of nature with its messages. Oh, spring, you are a letter I write to her. The future belongs even more to hearts than to minds. Loving is the only thing that can occupy and fill eternity. The infinite requires the inexhaustible. Love partakes of the soul itself. It is of the same nature. Like the soul, It is a divine spark. Like the soul, it is incorruptible, indivisible, imperishable. It is a point of fire that is inside us, that is everlasting and infinite, that nothing can limit and that nothing can extinguish. You feel it burn right to the marrow of your bones, and you see it shine out to the back of the sky. Oh, love, adoration, sensual joy of two minds that understand each other, of two hearts that are exchanged, of two glances that pierce each other through. You will come to me, won't you? Happiness. Strolling together in lonely expanses, blessed sparkling days, I have sometimes dreamed that now and then the hours broke away from the life of the angels and came down here below to traverse the destiny of men. God cannot add anything to the happiness of those who love each other except by giving them endless duration. After a life of love, an eternity of love is indeed an increase. But to increase the intensity itself of the ineffable felicity that love brings to the soul, that is impossible, even for God. God is the fullness of heaven. Love is the fullness of mankind. You look at a star for two reasons, because it is bright and because it is impenetrable. You have beside you a softer radiance and a greater mystery, a woman. All of us, whoever we may be, have beings we breathe in like air. If they are lacking, air is lacking. We suffocate. Then we die. To die for lack of love is appalling. The suffocation of the soul. When love has melted and blended two beings in an angelic and sacred unity, the secret of life is open to them. They are nothing more than the two sides of a single destiny. They are nothing more than the two wings of a single spirit. Love soar. The day a woman who passes you by radiates light as she walks, you are lost. You love. There is only one thing left for you to do, and that is to think of her so unwaveringly that she is forced to think of you. What love starts, only God can end. True love feels despair or delight over a glove lost or a handkerchief found, and it needs eternity for all its devotion and its hopes. It is composed at once of the infinitely big and the infinitely small. If you are stone, be a magnet. If you are plant, be sensitive. If you are man, be love. Nothing is enough for love. We have happiness. We want paradise. We have paradise. We want heaven. Oh, you who love each other, all these things are contained in love. Know how to find them in it. Love entails contemplation as much as the heavens and, more than the heavens, sensual delight. Will she come again to the Luxembourg? No, monsieur. It's in this church that she hears Mass, is it not? She no longer comes. Does she still live in this house? She moved. Where is she moved to? She didn't say. What a dismal thing not to know the address of one's soul. Love has its childish side. The other passions have their petty side. Shame on passions that make man petty. Glory be to the passion that makes him a child. It is a strange thing, you know. I am in darkness. There is a being that has taken the heavens with her in moving away. Oh, to be lying down side by side in the same grave, hand in hand, and from time to time gently to stroke each other's fingertip in the dark. That will do for my eternity. You who suffer because you love, love still more. To die of love is to live from it. Love. A somber, starry transfiguration is involved in this torture. There is ecstasy in agony. Oh, joy of the birds! It's because they have a nest that they are able to sing. Love is breathing in the heavenly air of paradise. Deep hearts, wise spirits, take life the way God made it.